Welcome back to the program as we turn our attention to branding and to the brands that we are all so familiar with as customers and as part of popular culture. We're going to talk about it with my guest, Debbie Millman. She's worked in the design business for over 25 years. She's president of the design division at Sterling Brands and a contributing editor to Print Magazine. And she's the author of a new book entitled Look Both Ways. Debbie Millman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. First of all, talk a little bit about what branding is. You know, it's one of those words that people hear all the time, and I'm not sure that they all see it quite the same way.
Oh, that's a great question to start with. Very meaty, jumping right in there. Well, there are a couple of what I would call standard answers, and I'll give you those first, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what I think brands are that goes a little bit even further. Most people think that brands are the promise of an experience. So you have a certain expectation when you buy Pepsi-Cola that it's going to taste a certain way, or if you engage in going into a Starbucks and then stand online and order the product, that there's going to be a certain expectation for what that's going to be and what that is going to provide for you. Other people think that brands are a personality or that which there is no replacement. But I think brands are actually a projection of sorts of our hopes and our dreams and our fantasies about who we want to project ourselves as in the world. So, for example, I will buy certain products, or people will buy certain products that they think might make them feel prettier or cooler or more athletic looking or just better. And those brands that make us feel better about ourselves end up being ways that we signal our affiliations and ultimately how we help to define our beliefs to the people that we associate with and even see on the street.
And in making that relationship, in the degree to which the brand helps us to project exactly what you're talking about, is that about a relationship between the individual and the brand, or the brand's relationship with the larger culture which people are then kind of plugging into?
In some ways, it's both. I mean, brands do more than they ever have before. They really do provide a context with which to assess not only the person, but the society that we're living in. And while brands are a relatively new thing in our history as a species, we have been creating, making, and marking products in our environment for our entire history. Cave drawings are a way in which we use to help document our experience and provide a context for those that saw those cave drawings to try and understand us. And in many ways, brands are symbols to help us understand where we are, what we're living in, how we're living, what we choose to surround ourselves by. There are ways in which we can document and name our experiences. We did that 132,000 years ago in caves. We still document and mark our environments with billboards and with advertising. We did that 100,000 years ago with tools that we made from stone. We do that now with tools that we make from with technology. We are behaving in quite a lot of the same ways that we always have as a species. We're just a bit more sophisticated in the way that we do it.
Our modern relationship with branding, some would argue that it is a sign of insecurity in some ways. I mean, I remember a campaign many years back, which I'm sure you do as well, for Bottega Veneta, which was, you know, when your own initials are good enough. The idea that somehow it reflects an insecurity in the culture today.
Well, that is an extremely insightful assessment. And I would never, ever deny that there is a certain compensation that brands provide humans. But that's not necessarily something that is relative only to brands. We try to do that with nearly everything. As I mentioned, we've been using different ways in which to improve our appearance to help us survive better for our entire history as a species. Egyptians were using makeup long before L'Oreal was created. I think there is something intrinsically hardwired in us as humans to ensure that we survive, and we survive by being better or best at something. However, in this particular day and age, there's no doubt that if something is considered universally in a society as cool or better than or something that will help augment one's appearance, that these are things that only work on the outside. They don't fundamentally change how you feel inwardly about yourself intrinsically. They might for a little while, but the problem with relying on brands to do that is that it's essentially a bit of an addiction. You just need more and more and more to feel better about yourself, and these brands help to buoy an otherwise fragile interior. And that's where we can get into trouble, by using brands to help improve our self-esteem or our internal spirit. They can't do that. What's interesting in terms of the way that brands are evolving in our society and our relationship to brands is that people are now more interested in how brands can make a difference in our lives. We're not as interested in a different flavored cola or a different flavored iced tea. We're much more interested and much more intrigued by and much more compelled by things that can really fundamentally make a difference in our lives. How can it make our lives easier? How could it make our lives more meaningful? And that's an interesting new chapter of branding that's just unfolding.
What then is the relationship between brands and individuality, and the way in which successful brands foster both themselves and individuality?
That's really interesting. It's not so much about individuality as you'd think. We use brands to connect ourselves to other people. We telegraph these values by using brands. Think of the Livestrong yellow bracelets. Think of how people first wore the earbuds attached to an iPod. We use brands in many ways to fit in to different groups, and we use these things to associate with other people that have those same tools or same signals that we are part of this clan. We use these things to create tribes now. Think about it. And it's very interesting from a psychological point of view. If you pull up to a red light and you're sitting in your car and somebody else pulls up to the red light next to you and they're in the same car, something really interesting happens. There's an immediate kinship, almost a I know that you know that I mm-hmm. know that you know that we made the same decision. Aren't we great for making that same decision? There's a fundamental sense of acceptance that happens when you see somebody that is experiencing life in that same way that you do. It's almost a I know that you get me moment. And that's really what brands provide. It's not so much about creating a sense of difference. It's actually a way of telegraphing what tribe you belong to in an effort to find other like-minded tribesmen, so to speak.
But the genius, and you know, you mentioned the iPod, which is an interesting example, because the genius of that in some ways is that it enables you to be part of the tribe, but you individualize it in a way that is unique to you. I mean, early on when the iPod was selling kind of the campaign of what's on your iPod, it was kind of the best of both worlds in that sense.
Right, and that's why that's one of the reasons that it's been so successful is because it also is truly making a difference in your life. You are able to carry around a soundtrack to your life in a very easy, very, very convenient way. And so it was a double whammy. It had the cachet of being a cool product. It had all of the visual signals that allowed somebody to express they were part of that tribe, but it was also delivering something that was truly unique. And, you know, there were a lot of MP3 players on the market before Apple came out with theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't so much about being an MP3 player as it was about having iTunes associated with the MP3 player, which allowed you to very easily, very conveniently, and very inexpensively develop a soundtrack to your lives that you could carry around with you at every moment of every day.
Does all of this kind of modern idea of branding, all the things that we've been talking about, make brands more fragile, more subject to public whims, and therefore easier to go away?
I don't think that they'll ever go away. I think that we have created a way to monetize our fundamental needs by needing things to survive, shelter, food, the need to look beautiful and to attract others is just part of our basic instinct for reproduction, believe it or not. What technology is allowing us to do is rate, rank, and assess those brands in a way that we've never had the power to do before. So the average consumer, as if there really is one, is able to participate in the language of that brand day to day. And one of the best examples that I can give you is what happened with Tropicana, that the backlash that was provided by consumers was part of what made the company take heed and change the packaging back to what consumers wanted and were most familiar with before. And that could never have happened 10 years ago because there wasn't the same type of equal dialogue with consumers that there is now via the use of social media.
Does it make the consumer more fickle with respect to brands?
I don't know that it makes the consumer more fickle, but it certainly makes them more demanding, and I think it makes the consumer product companies much more accountable to what they provide the consumer, because the consumer has an equal and very powerful voice, which is a remarkable thing. I mean, you have to think about that we've created all these technologies. We, as a species, have created all of these products. And in as much as 3 years ago, most of the time that we spent in front of our computers was a time where we were emailing or shopping or playing games. Now most of that time is spent engaging with other people. So we've sort of outsmarted ourselves in many ways. One of the basic human needs is connectivity, to be close with other people so that our brains can resonate with them. And what we've actually done is created an opportunity to do that in this other environment that was something that we were fundamentally engaged with, but also very isolated in doing that with. And so now people are now reconnecting with high school friends and ex-boyfriends and girlfriends and people that they may not have talked to for 30 years just because of this ability to find them and see them and connect with them online. And while that might not be terribly meaningful in terms of the depth of relationship, it's also now capable of connecting families in much more meaningful ways and much more regular ways. And we have created that technology in an effort to compensate for the lack of connectivity that the technology first enabled.
And for people that do what you do in consulting and in the branding business, does this sense of nowness and immediacy make it more difficult to brand because everything becomes more ephemeral?
It makes it more difficult because people do see through brands that don't have any true difference. It does make it more difficult for those marketers that are hoping to get away with Me Too products or products that aren't as sustainable as they should be, because consumers are, as you said, they're not necessarily more fickle, but they're very much more picky. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's a great thing. We have, consumers have more power than they've ever had before in our society.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the process that you engage in, that your colleagues engage in when approaching a product and trying to create that kind of brand relationship, that kind of brand identity.
Well, if we're working with a new brand, and for example, if we're working with an existing brand, we just help to redesign Campbell's Soup, the red and white can. And we also just recently worked with Nestle to redesign Häagen-Dazs. Now, these are brands that are both very, very entrenched in the iconography of our visual landscape. Mm-hmm. These are brands that are almost telegraphic in their ability to reach people. You don't have to look very hard to find what you want when you're looking for Häagen-Dazs or Campbell's Soup. You see them almost immediately just because of the visual language that the brands have developed over decades. But in the case of Häagen-Dazs, for example, one of the things that we did was, well, we speak to shoppers. We speak to the audience of people that are buying these brands. And we ask them to, for example, one of the things that we ask them to do is to draw the brand from memory. We do groups with people where we gather them together, and without showing them the brand, we'll ask them to draw the brand from memory. And one of the things that does is show us subconsciously or subliminally the visual magic that this brand has for people in their lives. They aren't able to look at it. They just close their eyes, and they remember what it looks like, and then they can viscerally draw the brand. And this tells us what those subliminal subconscious aspects of the brand are that we need to be able to retain or augment. In the case of Häagen-Dazs, people don't really need to see scoops of ice cream on this iconic package to know that it's an ice cream package. And so the new Häagen-Dazs package actually doesn't have any actual ice cream on it. It has the wonderful flavors that are in the ice cream, so that it becomes much more about flavor than it does about these big sort of balls of ice cream that don't really ever look like ice cream. Mm-hmm. If you look at ice cream packaging, it all doesn't really look like appetizing ice cream. So now it's a very pristine example of what the brand holds inside. And I think it's a remarkable change for Häagen-Dazs to undergo. In the case of Campbell's, what we've done was try to humanize the package a little bit more. You don't need to see a spoon. You don't need to see all sorts of cut-up ingredients outside the bowl to know what's in the bowl. And so now it's just a very beautiful, again, pristine photograph of the soup.
Mm-hmm. What about understanding those things that have become iconic in their own right, things like the Lacoste alligator or the polo, Ralph Lauren polo, those things that have established such powerful resonance, and trying to understand why they have?
Oh, it's fascinating. I mean, I remember when I was a little girl, I wanted a Lacoste shirt so much that, and my mother didn't really understand the need to have a polo shirt with a symbol of a reptile on it, when polo shirts without that were so much cheaper, and she didn't really understand why I wanted that so badly. But for me, having a Lacoste t-shirt or having a pair of Levi's would signify to other people, as exactly what we were talking about before, that I was cool. And I certainly didn't feel cool, and I knew that that could help maybe pretend that I was for a while. And I wanted a Lacoste shirt so much. I remember I rode my bicycle to the neighborhood craft store thinking that maybe I could find some sort of embroidered symbol that I could sew onto a polo shirt that might signify that I was as cool as somebody wearing a shirt with a crocodile on it. These are, again, they're projections of our hopes and our fantasies about how we want other people to view us. And Lacoste has spent quite a lot of money over decades marketing this brand in a way to have people believe that it is possible by the sheer nature of putting on this shirt, you will transform yourself into somebody maybe a little bit cooler than who you are. And I certainly bought into it and wanted it desperately. I never got the Lacoste shirt as a teenager, but eventually when Levi's went on triple markdown in Walt Whitman Mall, my mother ended up buying me a pair of lime green corduroy bell-bottom Levi's. This is in the 70s, and I didn't care that they were lime green, and I didn't care that they were corduroy. All I cared about was there was that little red tag on the back pocket that made me feel better about who I was at that moment in time.
Is there a relationship between branding, brand identity, and prosperity? In more prosperous economic times, do we see more of it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, brands, wearing brands to show off our prosperity or our virility or our attractiveness is peacocking. It's just part of the way that humans show ourselves off to become more alluring to those we want to attract. We see more of it in prosperous times because we have more money to do that with. It's a very human construct. We've created these ways to attract those that we want to attract. We see less of it in times of hardship because it's also something that is politically incorrect to show off when so many people might be in need. Otherwise, you're never going to see somebody peacocking in that way in societies where there is no prosperity because there is no need to do that, first of all, and second of all, it would actually be something that would be frowned upon and looked down upon.
So how much tougher does it make your job in tougher economic times like we're in now?
Well, I think that marketers now have to have an expertise in a lot of different disciplines than they might have had to before. I think that marketers now have to have an expertise in cultural anthropology so that they are fully understanding the pulse of the culture to understand what is important to people. You need to know about everything that's going on in the lives of humans. I think you have to have a real expertise in behavioral psychology, in understanding how the brain works. You need to have a strong understanding of economics. You know, people talk about, a lot of brand marketers have talked about in the last year and a half about the value proposition and because people are so much more concerned with getting the best product for the money, well, how can we create something that has more value? People are still buying things. They're still making choices about what to buy. It's really not so much about the value proposition as really creating something that's valuable to people. Mm-hmm. Why will they choose to spend their money on your product? It's not just about value. It's also about what is going to help them improve their lives and feel better about themselves. So it's also really understanding economics and then, of course, creativity, because you still need to telegraphically be able to express what this brand signifies to be able to solicit the imagination of the people that are looking at it.
What about the international aspect of all this, the globalization of products today and the need to create those symbols that are more universal in their appeal?
Well, I think that it's a double-edged sword. I think that there is a certain economic value and a certain familiarity that consumers appreciate in going from one culture to another or one country to another and seeing familiar brands that you know and love and trust. But I think there's also something a little bit sad about going from airport to airport, and I travel an awful lot, both nationally and internationally, and not necessarily knowing what airport you're in because there's always the same stores there, and they all look exactly the same. And so that homogeny, while there certainly is economic value to it and while there certainly is a psychological comfort in it, there is also a lack of cultural nuance and integrity that's being maintained by having this homogeny, which I think is scary and sad.
Is that something marketers are looking at, or is this something that is just a given in terms of marketing today, and that toothpaste isn't going back in the proverbial tube?
I think that marketers are struggling with that. I don't know that there is a one answer to that right now. I think that certainly you're going to see a certain brand image that's similar, and that will remain so. You're not going to see Starbucks look any different from one market to another in terms of the actual brand mark. But what you are seeing more of is our marketers that are offering more specific local products to satisfy the needs of cultural differences. So there's a certain integrity that is being maintained. So I think that remains to be seen. I think that the fact that you do have big global brands now, Twitter, Facebook, especially the brands that are online, all appearing in a certain manner, and those norms being very similar market to market, is certainly leading me to believe that there's going to be more of that as opposed to less of that. But I think there is also something really remarkable about going into a local market and experiencing brands that aren't global that do have the ability to really express the spirit of a culture.
The other part that you write about and look both ways and talk about that's kind of the corollary of this is not just the brand design, but design itself as it relates to so many things in our culture and to these experiences that we've been talking about and the growing importance of that in terms of people's experience.
Yes. Brands are doing more than they ever have before in our culture. That doesn't mean that we are using them in different ways. We've been making and marking things as humans since we have been on this planet. Our ability to survive has been as a result of our ability to make things and mark things in a way that has protected us, has allowed us to prosper. For example, our invention of fire, our ability to create fire so many hundreds of thousands of years ago actually created so many other ways in which we have been able to engage with each other. So, for example, just creating a campfire and allowing ourselves to cook food, which allowed us to digest better, that grouping of humans around the campfire actually created our ability to begin to communicate to each other, to talk to each other. And then we made tools that allowed us to hunt and be able to be more successful at hunting, and being more successful at hunting allowed us to protect ourselves better and create clothes which would allow us to stay warmer in colder climates, which allowed us to survive. So we've been doing this in different ways for our history as a species. It was only in 1876 that we first trademarked a brand, which gave the owner of that brand the legal ability to protect that trademark. And so we've just created different ways to monetize the very same things that we were doing before we had currency, before we had the ability to exchange one thing for another that had value. Before there was money, there was gold. Before there was gold, there was salt. We used salt as currency many thousands of years ago. So we just do these exchanges and are creating more and more and more sophisticated methodologies to enhance our appearance or to engage our taste buds or to make ourselves more alluring to each other or build better shelters so that we're more comfortable and, again, have the ability to survive better. We are using our creativity to enhance our basic instincts. We all do that.
Bringing us to the point that we are now, where we think of ourselves individually as our own individual brand.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We see more individual brands than we ever have before. What's interesting, I mean, there's Oprah and there was Cher, and now there's Oprah and Madonna and Lady Gaga. And, you know, these people, we could say their names and we conjure up their images and we know what they stand for. But they could fail as well. And those brands fail just like any other brands. I mean, look at what poor Tiger Woods has done to himself. And, you know, he'll recover just like Tylenol recovered. You know, it's really a matter of creating a way in which we understand the constructs in our society now. And so whether it's a person using a resume or a person using a logo or a person using a marketing campaign, these are ways in which we as humans use to understand who we are, where we stand in the world, and how we could connect to others in that same world.
Debbie Millman, her book is Look Both Ways, Illustrated Essays on the Intersection of Life and Design. Debbie, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.